and her body hard and strong. I stroked her for a long time. Then she greeted George and Nuru, and finally returned to the bush where her cubs were hiding. George did not think she looked any worse than she had on earlier occasions, when she'd been infested with maggots, and this relieved my anxiety. However, as she'd not eaten for 2 days, before I left, we placed meat on the river bank. While we did this, Elsa watched us from the far side. As she made no attempt to come over and collect it, George floated it across. He had to put it right in front of her before she rose, and without eating anything herself, dragged it up the steep slope and into the thicket where the cubs were. With this last picture of Elsa helping her children, I reluctantly left the camp for Nairobi. There, I received a telegram from George. "Elsa worse, has high fever, suggest bring oromycin." The message had been telephoned through from Isiolo by Ken, who had asked Major Grimwood to tell me that he had already sent the drug to George. I was terribly worried, but since help was already on the way, I decided, in view of the urgent need to make arrangements for the move, to stay one night in Nairobi. Major Grimwood told me that in the homes offered in the Rhodesias and Bechuana land, the ecological conditions would not suit Elsa or the cubs. Therefore, he advised us to move the lions to Lake Rudolph. He also suggested that the wire enclosure in the lorry had better be partitioned, since if we transported the family in a communal crate and one lion were to panic, it might hurt the others. Next morning, I got up early, as I had some urgent matters to attend to before leaving Nairobi. When I came downstairs, I found Ken waiting for me. He looked tired and dusty, having just arrived from Isiolo with a message from George that Elsa was now desperately ill. George had sent an SOS at midnight, asking for me to return and for a vet to come at once. Ken had got in touch with John MacDonald, the vet at Isiolo, who had left immediately. Then Ken had driven the 100 miles to Nairobi to give me George's message. How grateful I was to him. I chartered a plane, and soon Ken and I were on our way to the small Somali village, which was the nearest landing strip to the camp, at which we might be able to hire a car for the rest of our journey. We were lucky enough to find an old Land Rover, and in it drove the last 70 miles. We arrived at the camp about tea time, leaving the car some distance away so as not to alarm Elsa. I rushed to the studio. George was sitting there alone, and looked at me without saying anything. His expression told more than I could bear. When I had recovered from the shock, he took me to Elsa's grave. It was under a tree close to the tents, overlooking the river and the sandbank where Elsa had introduced me to her children. This was the tree on whose rough bark the cubs had learnt to sharpen their claws, and under the shade of which the family had so often played. George told me all that had happened while I was away. This is what he said. "After you had left, I moved my tent near to the ramp and waited for the family to appear, but that night they did not come. In the morning, I was obliged to visit a game post higher up the river, so it was not until the afternoon that I was free to look for Elsa. I saw the cubs playing on the far bank, and then found Elsa lying under a bush a little farther up the river. She got up and greeted me and Makede. The cubs came along and played around their mother. I then went back to camp. That night again, no lions appeared. Before breakfast, I went to look for Elsa. She was lying alone near the place where I had left her the night before. She replied to my calls, but did not get up to greet me. Her breathing was laboured, and she seemed to be in pain. She was obviously ill. I returned to camp, and at once dispatched the Thames truck to Isiolo with the telegram to let you know that Elsa was worse, and asking you to send oromycin. Then I went back to Elsa with water and a plate of meat and brains, into which I had mixed sulphur thiazole. She drank a little water, but even in spite of her liking for brains, did not eat anything. I then put some sulphur thiazole into the water, but she refused it. Later, I went back and had lunch. Afterwards, I returned to Elsa, and found that she had moved a little way and was lying in long grass. I felt very much alarmed, for she was steadily growing weaker. She would not look at food and only drank a little water, which I offered her in a basin. To leave her for the night was unthinkable, for in her weak state she might have been attacked by hyenas, buffalo, or by a lioness. I therefore decided to spend the night with her, and got the boys to bring my bed over from the camp, also the remains of the goat and a pressure lamp. I spent the night in the bush and kept the lamp burning. The cubs came up from the stream and ate the goat. Afterwards, Jesper tried to pull the blankets off my bed. Elsa seemed to be a little better. Twice she came up to my bed and rubbed her head affectionately against me. At dawn, Elsa seemed fairly comfortable, so I went back to camp for breakfast and then did some typing. About 10 o'clock, I began to feel anxious and went to look for Elsa. I could not find her. There was no answer to my calls, and no sign of the cubs. For 2 hours I searched up and down the river, and at last I found her lying half in the water by a little island near the camp. She looked desperately ill. Her breathing was very fast, and she was extremely weak. I tried to give her water in my cupped hands, but she could not swallow. I stayed with her for an hour, then suddenly she made an immense effort and went up the steep bank onto the island, where she collapsed. I called Nuru and got him to cut a path to a place from which it was easy to cross the river. Then I left Nuru in charge and went back to the camp and improvised a stretcher out of my camp bed and tent poles. I carried it back to the island and laid it beside Elsa, hoping that since she always liked lying on a bed, she might roll onto it. If she did this, I meant, with the help of the men, to carry her across the river to my tent. But Elsa did not attempt to get on the bed. About 3 o'clock, she suddenly rose to her feet and staggered to the river. With my help, she waded across it to the bank below the kitchen. She was completely exhausted by the effort, and lay for a long time on the bank. At least now she was on our side of the river, and close to the camp. The cubs appeared on the island, having no doubt followed their mother's scent, but they seemed nervous of crossing over. Stopping twice to rest, Elsa made her way to the sandbank below our tents. I showed some meat to the cubs, who followed my progress along the other side of the river as I dragged their dinner to the sandbank. Jesper and little Elsa swam across, but Gopa hesitated until he saw his brother and sister eating. Then he ventured to swim over and was ambushed by Jesper as soon as he landed. For the next 2 hours, Elsa lay on the sandbank with Jesper close to her. Twice she got up and went to the water's edge to drink, but she could not swallow. It was a pathetic sight. I tried pouring water from my cupped hands into her mouth, but it just dribbled out again. When it got dark, she walked up the narrow path and lay down at the place where my tent used to stand before I moved it up to the ramp. I tried to give her a little milk and whiskey by squirting it into her mouth with a syringe. She managed to swallow some of it. Then I covered her with a blanket and hoped she would not move. I was in despair, feeling sure she would not last out the night, anxious to send a message to you and worried because the truck was very much overdue. I realized that the only hope of saving her was to get a vet as quickly as possible. On the other hand, I did not want to leave her, in case she wandered off into the darkness, in which case it might have been impossible to find her. In the end, I decided to risk leaving her for an hour and a half, the time it would take me to go to the bad ford, where I thought the truck might be stuck. Less than 2 miles from camp, I met the truck, which had got stuck returning from Iziolo. The driver had brought the drug for Elsa. I wrote a letter to Ken, telling him that Elsa was in desperate need of a vet, and asked him to get in touch with you. Then I sent the driver straight back to Iziolo in my Land Rover. Fortunately, Elsa had not moved. The cubs had arrived, and I gave them some meat. It was impossible to get Elsa to swallow the drug. She had become very restless, would get up, move a few paces, and then lie down again. All my attempts to make her drink failed. At about 1:45 in the morning, Elsa went back to the studio and into the water. I tried to stop her, but she went resolutely on till she reached the sandbank under the trees, where she had so often played with the cubs. Here she lay on the sodden mud bank, evidently in great distress, alternatively sitting up and lying down, her breathing more laboured than ever. I tried to move her back to the dry sand of the studio, but she seemed beyond making any effort. It was a terrible and harrowing sight. It even crossed my mind that I ought to put her out of her misery, but I believed that there was still a chance that you might arrive with a vet in time to help her. At about 4:30, I called all the men in the camp, and with their help put Elsa on the stretcher, and with much difficulty carried her back to my tent. She settled down, and I lay beside her completely exhausted. As dawn was breaking, she suddenly got up, walked to the front of the tent, and collapsed. I held her head in my lap. A few minutes later, she sat up, gave a most heart-rending, terrible cry, and fell over. Elsa was dead. The cubs were close by, obviously bewildered and distressed. Jesper came up to his mother and licked her face. He seemed frightened, and rejoined the others who were hiding in the bush a few yards away. George told me that half an hour after Elsa died, John MacDonald, the senior veterinary officer from Easyolo, had arrived. Although George hated the idea, he agreed in the interest of medicine and of the cubs themselves that a post-mortem should be carried out to establish the cause of death. When this was over, Elsa was buried. At George's command, the game scouts fired 3 volleys over the grave. The reports echoed back from Elsa's rock. Perhaps somewhere in the sea of bush, her mate may have heard them and paused. It was the 24th of January, 1961. Next morning, the men collected 3 lorry loads of stones from the big rock. These were piled above Elsa's grave in a large cairn, and we cleared the surrounding ground of grass. Then we went to search for plants for Elsa's grave. Now we were the guardians of Elsa's children. Looking back, it seems to me as though there had been a pattern running through Elsa's life, of which even her untimely death was a part. While she was alive, her stigma of being semi-tame was bound to react upon her cubs and diminish their chances of living a natural life. It was because of their mother that they were to be expelled from their home and obliged to live on the grim shores of Lake Rudolph. Now that she was dead, it seemed possible that they might either be adopted by wild lions and allowed to remain where they were, or, if not this, then at least permitted to live in a game reserve or a national park, from both of which Elsa herself would have been banned on account of her friendship with human beings. The cubs were just the right age to adapt themselves to either alternative. I wondered whether Elsa, as so often in the past, had not solved a problem in her own way. We'd expected the cubs to become dependent upon us, but in fact they avoided us. Worried by the problem of how to regain the trust of the cubs, who would need our help for another 6 months, I lay awake that night. It was exactly a year since Elsa had brought them over the river to introduce them to us. The following afternoon, Nuru and I circled the rocks, fruitlessly. On our way home, we tracked hyena spoor, which led to the down palm logs near the camp, and there we found the cubs. Jesper followed me back to the tents and allowed me to stroke him while the boys were getting meat for him. When it appeared, He pounced on it and dragged it quickly to the other cubs who were hiding. Then, before starting his own meal, he returned to me and, placing himself in his safe position, invited me to play with him. He tilted his head and rolled on his back, but as I came up to him, made a lightning swipe at me. Instantly I jerked back. I'd often watched him playfully pressing his sharp claws into his mother's pelt. How could he know that my skin was different? I tried talking softly to Gopa, but he only growled at me and moved off with flattened ears. Jesper followed him, and then placed himself between the two of us, obviously protecting his brother. Suddenly, we were interrupted by a snort from the salt lick. While I collected my torch, Jesper removed the carcass into a thorn thicket. Although so young, and himself in need of help, he was proving a responsible leader of the pride, always ready to care for his brother and sister. At tea time, George arrived from Isiolo. We had now received the result of Elsa's post-mortem. She had died of an infection by a tick-borne parasite called Babesia, which destroys the red blood corpuscles. The 4% infection which they found had proved fatal because of the weak condition to which she had been reduced by the bites of the mango flies. It was the first time that such an infection had been found in a lion. On the day of George's return, he brought news that Major Grimwood would be passing through Isiolo the next day, so I decided to meet him there, since we wanted to discuss the cubs' future with him. If it were necessary to move them, we hoped that he would help us find a home for them in an East African game reserve. Major Grimwood proved most sympathetic and promised to contact the authorities of the national parks of Kenya and Tanganyika. I brought an old crate back to camp with me. It had originally been made to take Elsa to Holland. Now I hoped to induce the cubs to feed inside it. Then one day, when all three were inside, we would close the door, and disguising a tranquilizer in marrow, we would administer a dose in each of the three pie dishes. The cubs would be safe inside the crate during the time the drug was taking effect. This was important, for we didn't want them to wander about in a state of semi-consciousness and perhaps become a prey to predators. As soon as they'd been immobilized by the drug, we intended to transfer them to three separate crates, specially designed to fit the back of a 5-ton lorry. We decided to have three sides of the crates made of iron bars, so that during the journey, the cubs would be able to see each other, and without being able to do any harm, could give each other moral support. There was, of course, a greater risk that they might get chafed against the bars, but we felt that this physical damage would heal more easily than a mind which had been injured by panic, which might arise when travelling in a dark box. The fourth side of the crates was to consist of a wooden trap door. Having made up our minds about this, I set off to Nanyuke, 220 miles away, to order the travelling crates. On the way home, I passed through Isiolo, where I found a message from a pharmaceutical firm offering to supply medicine which might help the cubs to overcome their present state of anxiety. Since Elsa's death, we had received many letters of sympathy, letters which proved how well she'd been loved by people all over the world. Various officials connected with zoos had suggested taking the cubs, but this was the first practical offer which took their immediate condition into account. I waited in Isiolo until I could meet the representatives of the firm, and was much touched by their gift of the antibiotic terimycin in powder form, which they believed would strengthen the resistance of the cubs. I was also extremely grateful for their advice on tranquilizers. Our inquiries had suggested that Librium was the only one which we could risk giving the cubs. Lions are not only highly sensitive to drugs, but are also apt to react to them individually, and therefore unpredictably. On the 27th of February, we found the cubs on the top of the Woofing Rock, resting in the shade of some Candelabra euphorbias. Jesper came when we called to him, sat close to me and tilted his head, but kept his eyes fixed on Gopa and his sister. After a time, little Elsa came a little nearer to us, but Gopa kept aloof and behaved as though we did not exist. I saw an unusually large tick on Jasper and was alarmed.